Well, I live in the School of Medicine at the University of Washington and do work on directly out of the pathology department on brain tumors. And a few of you probably have heard portions of this talk, especially if you were in Germany maybe a month ago. There's going to be some overlap, but I figured there was enough new folks that it was worthy to sort of go over it a bit. Your introduction actually worked out perfectly. It was described exactly the clinical significance of all of this that I didn't have to spend much time on. But I will give one background picture because I love this slide. This is a picture out of a standard medical school text of a primary brain tumor, and it's exactly this nut that we're talking about. You know, you imagine a tumor as some sort of nut in the head, and the reality is just radically different. Your picture was excellent. The thing I like about this one is that you've got a lesion that's originating right here, but you've got some extensive invasion, specifically across the white matter corpus callosum connecting the two cerebral hemispheres, where these tumor cells are invading over long distances. And that's radically different from what is taught in the medical school text. And is radically different than what is conventionally thought about a lot of tumors, maybe not all. So I feel these tumors, maybe because I've worked on them for too long, are just sort of very unique in many ways, specifically regarding their invasion. So just to clarify for those of you not familiar with slices of brains from autopsies, this is sort of the outline of what would be considered, you know, a macroscopic tumor. But as Dr. Guha mentioned, if you biopsy at this location, this location, this location, you can actually, if you are a not blind pathologist, if you have not gone blind from staring in the microscope, that is, you would be able to, in theory, locate malignant glioma cells. And within humans during surgeries, there have been biopsies more than 4 centimeters away from the palpable tumor, from the imageable tumor, that have grown in culture malignant tumor cells. So what I would like you to do is sort of visualize this concept of that gliomas are diffusely invasive lesions, and imagining you're walking along this yellow line throughout the brain, and you're sort of looking around for all the malignant glioma cells mixed in with all the normal white and gray matter of the brain. And with that in mind, you're going to get some sort of distribution that's probably going to look something along these lines. So you've got low cell density of gliomas here, where there's lots of normal cells. As you get towards the center of the lesion, there's going to be high cell density. That's the portion that we could actually detect just visually. That's the portion that's imageable on standard clinical imaging like MRI. And then as you go off the other edge, you're going to have a similar difference. In the center, you're going to have this, in at least high-grade gliomas, you'll probably have a necrotic core, so there may be some dip. But basically, these tips of this, what I refer to as the iceberg, will be detectable on whatever imaging modality you're using. And what we're really interested in is not so much what's happening at the tip of the iceberg. Granted, we're interested in how bulk effects are treated by surgery and how other treatments, cytotoxic perhaps treatments, are affecting the change in this. But any cure or long-term survival in these patients is going to be associated with some sort of suppression of these guys out here. And we can't see those guys out there on present imaging. So what do we do about that? And that's where I think mathematical modeling comes in. So if you were to just explain a bit more, if you biopsy in each of these locations in a brain just like the one I just showed you on the previous slide, you'll see central necrosis. These are standing H&E stains for central necrosis, nice vascular, hyperdense portion of the tumor here. You get a little further away and you've got some malignant looking, not a ridiculously high cell density. And then out of the periphery, you're almost looking normal. It almost looks like normal white matter out there. So this basic mathematical model that is sort of forms the backdrop of everything I do, though there's lots of different subtleties to different aspects of this, really just describes in math what I just described in English in the previous slide. So if you just look at the word equation, it's really all I would like you to see. The rate of change of the tumor cell density at any location within the brain is going to be thought to be a component of two key characteristics. Granted, there's probably a million other key characteristics involved in how gliomas progress and how gliomas behave day to day, but let's just stick to these two and see where it gets us. We've got net dispersal of the tumor cells, the fact that the cells are invading long distances, and net proliferation of the tumor cells. So they're proliferating, but they're also dying off by some form of apoptosis. Now, the thing that I'd like you to glean from this is just simply that there's the two parameters, D and rho. I talk about them forever during this talk, and specifically, that this, the D has a, is a function of a spatial variable X, differentiating regions of gray and white matter. So in gray matter, it turns out the glioma cells tend to migrate much less than they do in the white matter. And there's actually some associated anisotropy in the white matter, and I won't show you pictures of that here, but I'll we have worked on that. So with this in mind, turns out that simulations of that distribution of that curve gives you a curve very similar to this gray curve that I've drawn here, where you've got a high maximal cell density towards the center that could form a necrotic core. It doesn't actually show you demonstrate the necrotic core, but it turns out that the what you're interested in is what's happening out here, and so that doesn't significantly change things. So the problem, of course, is that such a model covers a multitude of sins, and this is just a partial list. You can add about 10 slides from Dr. Guha's lecture also on all the various molecular genetic pathways that are, of course, important to each of these processes and other processes that are happening within gliomas. But the point is that the vast majority of pathways that we're interested in, either on this slide or in this slide, tumble down to their have effects either at the net proliferation level or at the invasion level. The other sort of net effect that I haven't described here is related directly to angiogenesis, which is separate than these things, and it's something that we're actually actively working on in the lab. But with this in mind, we know there's lots of complexities, and if we're looking at a specific drug that's targeting any of these pathways, we can add a model to the mathematical model that I've described in the previous slide to deal with these bits in some way. Now, the slant to everything that I'll be talking about today will be mostly related to clinical patients, clinical imaging of patients, specifically the fact that we're going to, for the vast majority of, for all of gliomas, we're really back to this sort of tip of the iceberg picture. For high-grade gliomas, the glioblastomas, you have the standard imaging modality that is used is T1 weighted gadolinium MRIs. And the T2 MRI is usually sort of a secondary measure that's used. But if you were to biopsy within the T1 weighted gadolinium positive region, this bright area here, you would get something that looks bulky tumor, nearly solid tumor termed by a pathologist. Whereas if you biopsy outside of the T1 GAD positive region, but within the T2 positive region, you'd find isolated tumor cells and edema of the brain. So we're going to sort of trot along this conceptual path with thinking of, again, our iceberg of a tumor when we have two levels of detection associated with the two types of imaging modalities that are most commonly used in the clinic. But again, I had mentioned earlier that the brain is complex, and we all know this. If you look at the pictures of the cells on the left, this is sort of the neurons, and a stain for basically the neurons or the cell bodies, and then this is looking at the fibers within the brain. You can see that there's one massive complexity to the structure of the brain, but if cells are migrating more quickly in the white matter than they are in the gray matter, then there's also going to be significant heterogeneity to how the tumor actually grows. So that heterogeneity in the D coefficient that I refer to. And here's just a 3D reconstruction from an MRI of showing the complexity. So with that in mind, I'm just going to orient you with a slide that shows you a simulation of that mathematical model on the 3D architecture of a brain, of a sort of a reference brain. This is a frontal tumor originating at this asterisk location here. Red is high cell density contour, blue is a low cell density contour, and all the contours in the middle are some measure in between. So the highest cell density is centrally, the lowest cell density is in blue out here, but this outermost blue contour is not the zero cell density, it's just some low cell density measure. And this thick black contour is what we associate with approximately the T1 weighted gadolinium MRI detectable edge. So everything within this black contour is what you're seeing in the clinic. Everything out here is what you're not seeing, and so you can imagine the conundrum of any physician sitting in the clinic looking at these patients being restricted to only be able to view this, and maybe if they consider the flare imaging all the way out to this sort of aqua-colored region, the reality is that these tumor cells really have invaded quite long distances peripheral to any of the imaging abnormalities we're seeing. But again, you're restricted to only having the view of what the MRI is showing you because you don't have the advantage of being able to sample an apparently normal brain in most patients. Certainly can't get away with that in the U.S. anymore. So here's a simulation of that where you look at, this is a three-dimensional simulation, but I only show it to you in the standard 2D planes associated with the standard radiological planes. Thick blue contour, I don't know why it's blinking. Thick blue contour is the lowest cell density. Red is going to be highest. You're going to look for a very thick black contour that's going to be the edge of detectability on T1-weighted gadolinium MRI. So that whole simulation is about 128 days. Multiply it by 10 and be about reasonable clinical scale. And I purposely just got rid of the extra 10 because it's easier to count in the ones of days than it is to count in tens of days. And you have this thick black contour that didn't show up until well over 100 days into this time scale. So the clinically relevant regime is tiny compared to the whole lifespan of these tumors. We are way at the end of any of being able to say we're going to get ahead of the invasion before the invasion happens. The invasion's done happen by the time the patient shows up in the clinic. This outer contour has not moved significantly between the time it was detectable by this modality and the time that it's fatal on this modality. So the only hope that you could have with this hypothesis is that you would be able to stop migration and stop proliferation of the cells that are sitting wherever they're at throughout the brain, not that you would be able to remove them or get ahead of them. At least that's what the indication is for this. So with that in mind, we can also do fun things, you know, because this is all in silico. I love that word. We can all do fun things and, you know, start hacking up brains. So I became a neurosurgeon for a day just to irritate my local neurosurgeons and did a simulation just like the one I just showed you. Blue contour lowest. Thick black contour is the edge of detectability on the MRI, T1-weighted gadolinium. And I performed a, you know, radical frontal lobectomy, which I giggle about this every time. And the funny thing is that you see this, you can watch this movie, and this movie goes on until about 900 days. The point is the way I showed this movie the first time to my group of neurosurgeons in Seattle was to only show them that thick black contour, restrict them to what would be, in theory, clinically viewable. You go in, you do a radical resection of a very optimistic tumor, lobar, so it's very far front. It's very easily accessible. In theory, you could actually do a surgery approximately like this, in theory, and not get in too much trouble. And it was only 1 centimeter in diameter when it was diagnosed. So these are all optimistic things for these tumors. And so I only showed the thick black contour, and I just sort of talked in between about how there was a simulation happening in the background, and look, we've virtually cured the patient, and isn't that great? Sort of kind of being cruel, actually, because I was knowing full well that the simulation would continue and there would be some other things happening. Now, when you rerun the same exact simulation, which is the second thing I did, you rerun the simulation just like this, where you get the advantage of seeing some of the contours that you couldn't, in theory, see on any imaging modality, you get a sense of the continuum of behavior. Nothing has changed except for a large block of it has been removed. The continuum behavior, the D and the rho, the rate of migration of the individual cells and the rate of net proliferation of the individual cells in the simulation has not changed. Though it looks like a radical difference, because if you're just tracking the tip of the iceberg shown on the T1-weighted gadolinium MRI, you see a radical growth of this secondary lesion significant time after the surgery. And this really at least hit home amongst the group of neurosurgeons I was dealing with, because they see this in the clinic. It's, you know, a common thing where you have a nice radical surgery, you feel very confident about it, and some months later, some days later, there's a significant recurrence, and it looks like the recurrence is going even faster, even though the biological behavior of these in silico cells has not changed. The dynamic is still happening. Okay, so this is all well and good. So far I've just shown you simulations, and simulations is fun, but still not the whole point. The point is, how can we really apply this type of knowledge to individual patients? So let's go back to our image of what we know about the two types of imaging modalities and think about the mathematical model. One of the first things about the mathematical model is that it's a Fisher-type equation. You expect a traveling wave solution to it. The traveling wave solution is going to look something, is going to be the edge of detectability on either of these imaging modalities is going to progress at approximately a linear rate, proportional to both the migration rate and the proliferation rate of the cells, the mean migration rate and proliferation rate of the cells. So when you take that into account, this is one of the first sort of conclusions of the model. And well, that's simple. So that's one of the first things I did was talk to as many neuro-oncologists as I could and ask them, okay, so what do you think about linear growth of these lesions and sort of mean diameter of a tumor? Do you expect linear growth to be reasonable? And I got every answer from that's absolutely impossible to predict what's going to happen the next day for a high-grade glioma or a low-grade glioma or any glioma. To the, if it is anything, it's going to be like exponential growth or something like that. But the vast majority of responses I received, that it was not predictable at all. So the idea behind what I've just shown you is that although the total number of glioma cells throughout the whole brain may be growing exponentially, the proportion that's detectable on T1-weighted gadolinium MRI is only growing linearly in time when you plot the radius of it. So I got with a group of neuro-oncology folks in Paris who happened to do serial follow-up of low-grade gliomas over a significant period of time, up to about 15 years. And this is not very common to find this data set. It's more common to find it for low-grade gliomas than it is for high-grade gliomas, because a patient comes in with a high-grade glioma and they're sort of immediately treated. They're immediately put into the system. But a low-grade glioma, a patient can often be followed for some time to look for significant movement in the tumor or significant associated symptoms before a surgery happens or before radiation is introduced. So if you plot the diameter versus time, and this is, I've adjusted the time scale here to sort of shorten up the number of slides I was doing, but this is published a couple years ago in the Annals of Neurology. You see that as a group, these tumors seem to be progressing along a common straight line in terms of diameter and time, but also individually, there's a fairly common behavior. There's a linear, the heterogeneity within that is still, each tumor progresses in a fairly linear manner. These measures are taken from standard MRIs, but it's only the three perpendicular measures. It's not actually calculating the volume and determining what the mean diameter is. It's taking three perpendicular measures, so there's a lot of error in the way these measures are taken. And I was surprised that it actually came out so well. This was actually a fairly fundamental change in the understanding of gliomas because, again, the conventional wisdom, at least the folks that I talked to, was that they're fairly unpredictable tumors, and yet you can draw a straight line through these curves and generate a predictable path at about 2 millimeters a year for a low-grade glioma. But it turns out for high-grade gliomas, so those are the same 27 low-grade gliomas, which I now have about 350 of these patients with similar behaviors, showing a progression of about 2 millimeters per year in radius. In high-grade gliomas, I mentioned that they're much more rare. I have four of them on this graph. I actually have more than that. I probably have a dozen more. It's one of these graphs that needs to be updated one of these days. Four untreated high-grade gliomas, and the average comes out to be about 10 times difference. But instead of 2 millimeters per year, it's about 20 millimeters per year, which is exactly what you expect, considering the survival is about tenfold difference. It's about 10 years for low-grade gliomas and about 1 year for high-grade gliomas. With that in mind, one, the first thing is we've got some idea that there is maybe some predictability to the growth of these lesions. And here's just another plot of those velocities. But in addition to this traveling wave solution thing, it turns out you can actually deduce a relationship by looking at the difference between the size on T1-weighted gadolinium MRI and the T2 MRI, to deduce the relationship between the relative migration rate and the relative proliferation rate. So you have to look at mathematical solutions to the mathematical equation several slides ago, and to be able to define this relationship. And I draw it as a straight line slope, but it's not. It's some nonlinear relationship that's not worth writing down here between this size and this size. Detectable on these two imaging modalities. And I wasn't really completely convinced that this would do anything, but I tried it anyways, tried to use it on what data we did have available. So here's one case, one of those rare cases of a high-grade glioma that's followed with multiple imaging time points, but no intervening treatment. 75-year-old female presenting with a complex partial seizure. She refused advice to receive a biopsy for diagnosis and treatment, but she accepted four MRIs, it turns out, at different institutions. So this really gives you a sense of what's going on here. Here's a flare, sort of like a T2 MRI on the left, and here's a similar protocol MRI. 9 months later, you can see the massive growth on a fairly comparable slice of the brain. So the tumor is a pretty aggressive grower, and you can see that anybody with a lesion like that, it would progress very to fatality pretty quickly. And the test was, first of all, within individual cases, is this linear growth predictable? So I plotted the first two time points I have. I have a total of four time points. Don't get excited yet. Got two time points. Can fit a straight line through that. Everybody in the room can handle that. And I can actually calculate what these parameter estimates are from the clinical imaging. And once I do that, it turns out that the predicted growth is what happens. The tumor falls right along the lines that you expect it to fall on. What is kind of interesting about that is that, one, there is some predictability to the path of tumors. Two is that the clinical correlate of behavior within the individual or neurological status in a broad way is measured by this Karnofsky performance score. And you can see that the patient neurologically, other than a complex partial seizure at this presentation, the patient had remained very strong in terms of performance and had a precipitous decline just right before her final MRI. Well, this patient actually came to autopsy. So not only do we get the imaging, this is the first imaging time point, and using those model calculated parameters of D and rho, you do simulations and you can do comparisons of edge of this versus edge of this, edge predicted by the model. And the real question you want to know is, are these contours that you're predicting by the model comparable to what's happening in vivo? Well, we don't have that privilege to go and mutz around in somebody's brain, but it turns out you can do that when the patient comes to autopsy. So you can project those simulations forward to autopsy and do direct comparisons there. So it's a little bright in here to be able to see this, but you can see that on the left this is the brain slice of the patient's brain cut in this plane, in the horizontal plane. You can see a simulation of that and sort of an overlay of that. And we're working on a wide variety of these within the lab. Doing direct comparisons between simulations and autopsy data. Now, that was a rare case of a untreated glioblastoma. But the problem is that near the vast majority of these patients are treated. So what do we do about that? Here is a study of 70 high-grade gliomas. Again, these are all glioblastomas treated with the standard therapy, radiation therapy, having followed with either receiving a biopsy for diagnosis, a subtotal resection, which is sort of just a big biopsy in most cases, and a gross total resection. All these extensive resections were determined by imaging 48 hours after treatment. So using the diagnostic MRI only, can we use any of the information I presented in these sort of idealized cases of the previous slides, where I have multiple imaging time points before anything happens to these patients, to predict something about these tumors? So here's a plot of the sizes of these tumors. Turns out that the gross total resection patients were fairly advantaged by the fact that they're in general smaller tumors than the biopsy subtotal patients, which is not at all surprising to me. So here's what the actual survival time was for the biopsy and subtotal resection patients. It turns out biopsy and subtotal resection patients responded about the same rate. They have about the same survival curves. If you do simulations and predict survival using the mathematical model, calculating the D over rho from the initial sizes on MRI, you get a survival curve that looks like this, which matches quite nicely. So the mathematical model seems to be picking up on something that's pretty fairly legitimate here. And in addition, you can look at gross total resection patients. So you remember the simulation I showed you a little while ago where I did this massive lobectomy. You can do simulations of various grades of surgery in a similar manner. And these patients this is, again, the red curve being the actual survival curve for these patients. Again, perform this analysis where you look at the T1 GAD and the T2 MRIs, get the relative value of the parameters, and you can predict survival curves. Well, you can predict the survival curve. This is the predicted survival curve if no treatment had happened or biopsy subtotal resection had happened. If you actually include the effects of surgery, a gross total resection could either be just resection of the object that's there or a resection of the object plus a bit more. So this is the circles are resecting just the object. This is resecting the tumor at plus about 25% more than whatever was visible. And you see that there's a nice overlay between the predicted survival curves and the actual survival curve in these patients. Again, using a very simple model and using only the diagnostic MRI to predict survival in these patients. What's interesting is if you view that same data a bit differently, if you look at both groups of patients altogether, the red is the gross total patients, the blue are the biopsy subtotal patients. The boxes are the virtual controls. Those are the ones where you generate in the computer in silico a tumor that has that same D over rho value. You do simulations, and it turns out that although if you are doing a study from the clinical perspective and all you have is the asterisk, the starred information on both of these curves, the difference in median survival is quite significant. I think it turned out to be like 24 weeks for these patients, and that was reportable. But if you take into account that the gross total resection patients were actually smaller than on average than the biopsy subtotal patients, half of that advantage in survival is accounted for right there by looking at virtual controls. So this gets to your question, gets to the question of whether you can use virtual controls or independent controls within each patient. Can each patient serve as their own control to see what their projected path of behavior is going to be and compare whatever the treatment that's happening at the time is to that projected path? So with that in mind, here's a treated glioblastoma. Here's one of these great cases in which you have two imaging time points before the treatment begins. Here's the two imaging time points connected by a straight line. So assuming linear radial growth of these lesions, you expect things to trot right along this curve. Well, the patient had a subtotal resection. So let's assume subtotal resection, everything that's remained, nothing. Let's assume nothing has changed biologically. Let's not change the parameters of the model and just connect it up a straight line to that. Okay, that would be the predicted path, assuming if no treatment had happened. Well, treatment happens. Sometime later, there's standard approach with, it turns out this patient had concurrent chemotherapy and radiation therapy. And when you include that effect, there's going to be presumably some change during chemotherapy and radiation therapy. And then after chemotherapy and radiation ends, I would guess that it would go back to its normal behavior. And that's exactly what happens. The slope of the solid lines are exactly the same. It's all 27.5 millimeters per year. During the treatment, the velocity slowed down. But if you plot it in this way, you get the advantage of seeing sort of the background behavior, that control behavior that I'm referring to. What's interesting about this is if you extract your eyes and get rid of all the lines, if you just looked at the dots, and more specifically looked at all the dots on a volume plot, which would be a more standard way to plot this, plot volume versus time, it would be really hard to glean any information out of that relationship. But by having the mathematical model in the background, just to be able to connect the lines, you find out that there's actually some information that can be gleaned. And specifically, you can quantify the effect of this treatment on this patient relative to what the background behavior was. And then you can actually quantify what the increase in expected survival was for this patient. So this is the type of patients that we do work on. We do a wide variety of other things, but this is sort of an outline of some of those things. One of the things that we are working actively on now is looking at other imaging modalities, trying to use, in the same way that we've used MR to predict some information about the relative contributions of migration and invasion of these tumors, migration and proliferation of these tumors, what can we use with not anatomic imaging like MRI, but functional imaging like PET? So we've looked at a wide variety of tracers, everything from the standard FDG that happens quite a lot, to more experimental tracers looking at things from DNA and membrane biosynthesis, as well as hypoxia. And this gets into a whole different section of stuff that I do in the lab, so I will cut it off here and just show you a couple interesting pictures. Basically, PET is a dynamic imaging tool in which you can obtain within each voxel within this image. So this is the MRI. These are examples of FDG, Dynamic is a dynamic imaging modality. It's not like MRI where you just get a picture and that's the end of the day. Within each of these patients, you inject a tracer into the patient, and that tracer follows some metabolic pathway within the body, whatever that pathway is, and they're listed here for each of these tracers. And you have dynamic information within each voxel. You have what happens to that tracer within the voxel, and you also have what's happening within the plasma of a patient. So if you, say, for instance, look at fluorothymidine PET, which is, again, a DNA biosynthesis tracer, in this case of a 65-year-old patient with a gliosarcoma, you see here's the standard T1-weighted gadolinium MRI, here's the T2 MRI, here's the FLAIR MRI for that patient, and here's the SLT, or SUV in this case. So this is the summed version of taking the dynamic information from the FLT scan and looking at the sum of it. And that gives you some information about this is where the bulky portion of the tumor is, this is where a more diffuse portion of the tumor is, this is also where a more diffuse portion of the tumor is, and this is where the active significant proliferation is, assuming FLT is getting to throughout the brain, which is a whole other question. But where modeling comes in is that you have dynamic information. You have dynamic information in the blood, and you have dynamic information in the tissue, and you know what's going on in the plasma, you know what's going on in the tissue because you have the image, and you want to back calculate the relative how the FLT is being metabolized. And what we're specifically interested in is once the FLT leaves the plasma, enters the tissue as free FLT, but then becomes phosphorylated on this step right here, this is the interesting step where you generate the FLT monophosphate, and this is the interesting step associated with DNA biosynthesis. So we're interested in this flux, the flux through this little path right here. So the mathematical modeling you can do is look at three-dimensional images of this, having both the plasma information and the tissue information in a given location, and generate plots of just flux from these sort of images. That's where some of the work is going on in our lab, looking at combining this type of imaging modality with these type of other models that I've spatial temporal models that I've been working on. But I guess the major conclusion of what I've talked about today is that given a pretreatment slope, like two MRIs, or further information provided by another imaging modality, maybe PET, hence the reason I'm looking at PET, the model can prove the effectiveness, the mathematical model that I showed you on the first slide, can prove the effectiveness of any treatment in terms of net proliferation and migration rates. And yet, it's what you're interested in. You have some new drug that's supposedly targeting migration of cells. Does it actually affect migration of cells in vivo in humans? It's actually a very hard question to test unless you have an imaging modality that targets exactly that. I'm proposing being able to use that with standard clinical MRI. And underlying all this is that patients can serve as their own controls. Now, granted, this is a simple model with net proliferation and net dispersal of tumor cells, but any number of molecular genetic mechanisms seem to flow down into these two pathways at minimum. There are probably a lot more complexities that can be added, but this seems to be doing a decent job. So here's just a subset of the collaborators involved in what I talked about here today. And, of course, I have to acknowledge all my support. And that's it.